2015. This is the Hermetic Hour, and I'm your host, Poke Runyon, and tonight we present a discussion on the quasi-Masonic Rite of Memphis, sometimes called the Rite of Memphis and Mizraim, which is highly irregular in Orthodox Masonic circles and is usually considered a clandestine, that's unrecognized and proscribed organization, to which regular Masons cannot belong. Now, this collection of rites or degrees, 96 of them, actually 97, has a long and colorful history, which we will delve into consulting Mackey, Calvin C. Brett, John Yarker, and Alan Greenfield. And in the 1880s, the Rite of Memphis infiltrated the Scottish Rite Northern jurisdiction and went into competition with Scottish Rite itself to see which system would become an accepted advanced, that's a Red Lodge, along with the York Rite for regular American Masons. Scottish Rite's 33-degree system won out on this turf war with Albert Pike's help. And the Rite of M&M disappeared into the College of Defunct Masonic Rites. Yes, there is such an institution. And the same thing had happened to it in France 100 years earlier, when the Grand Orient absorbed it and locked it up in their archives. But the M&M is not easily suppressed. Its founder, after signing it over to the Grand Orient, sneaked it into Moldavia, one of Dracula's hangouts, and it briefly rose again. Now, recently, Masonic mavericks Alan Greenfield and Jeff Peace to resurrect it here in the United States. Jeff Peace trying to get a number of regular Masons who were interested in the esoteric, involved in the M&M at their peril. So, if you would like to explore a delightfully conspiratorial and deliciously controversial secret society that claims to have all the secrets of ancient masonry and certainly enough of its degrees, well then, tune in with us and we'll sail up the Nile and visit the pyramids. Oh, we have a really big show tonight, like Ed Sullivan used to say. 97 degrees, oh boy. And this is really, I think, a fascinating subject. And we're going to let various authorities do the show for us. And I have here with me a stack of weighty tomes. The first weighty tome, of course, I have is by Waite himself, and that's the New Encyclopedia of Freemasonry. And then I have Albert Mackey's big blue encyclopedia. What do they call this thing? But Mackey's Revised Encyclopedia of Freemasonry, Volume 2. And then I even have Kenneth McKenzie's The Royal Masonic Encyclopedia. So we are going to get hand on top of that. I have, and best yet, I have Secret High-Degree Rituals of the Masonic Rite of Memphis by John Yarker. And John Yarker, of course, rewrote a few of them and probably improved them somewhat. But let's start out, I think, with the comment by Albert Pike. And I'll read this in, and of course, you know, General Pike, was... had a regiment of American Indians that fought against the Yankees during the Civil War, and or the War Between the States, as they call it in the South. And he got in a lot of trouble because his Indians were scalping Yankees, and that wasn't so good. But so what Albert Pike had to say about the Rite of Memphis. Whatever the merits of the Egyptian Rite or Rite of Memphis may be, it is quite sure that it is not generally recognized as a legitimate rite of Freemasonry. That the bodies of it in the United States of America are entitled to and receive no consideration, it having been constantly used here for the purposes of private profit, and that elsewhere in the world it has only here and there two or three isolated supreme powers which cannot be recognized nor have any relations or correspondence and enmity with those of the ancient and accepted right. Now, let me elaborate a little bit on what Pike says here. What he's saying is that whatever grand lodges overseas recognize the right of Memphis, there's no reciprocity with Scottish, with ancient accepted Scottish right. That's what he means. Now, then this was Albert Pike, January 20th, 1884. Now, however, at some time, after that, I don't know exactly how long after that, but United Grand Lodge of England obviously did allow John Yarker to particular version of it, the situation with the Grand Orient, which we'll get into as we go through this, the Grand Orient in France. Now, some people think the Grand Orient is the only Grand Lodge in France. That's not true. There are two of them. There's the Grand Lodge of Masons in France, and then there is this Grand Orient. And the Grand Orient is, it's more interested in esoteric sort of rites, perhaps, than the regular French Grand Lodge. But two different times, it took both the rite of Mizraim, which came earlier, and then the rite of Memphis, and it took them under its jurisdiction, and then it locked them away. It said, and the reason why it did this, is because, and this is the whole meat of the situation, the Grand Orient in France is entirely in sympathy with Scottish Rite. In fact, Scottish Rite is originally French. It's not Scottish. The Scottish Rite's originally French, and the Grand Orient was its repositories. And the Scottish Rite has 33 degrees. And if you are a Scottish Rite Mason, you have to take an oath that there are no more than 33 degrees. And so consequently, if the Grand Orient in France, they realized that this Mizraim and then years later Memphis were both collections of Scottish Rite degrees that had been not even that much redone. They were just copies of these degrees. And what had happened was that the founders claimed that these are just the earlier versions and we have an older rite. One of the founders actually had been in Scottish Rite and had access to the Scottish Rite scripts, and then he got thrown out of Scottish Rite for bad conduct, and the scripts went with him, and of course they went into the Rite of Memphis and Mizraim. So let's get Albert Mackey out here, and we'll see what he has to say about this whole thing. And so I'm into the big book here. Memphis, right of. In 1839, two French Freemasons, named respectively Marconis and Moulay, of whom the former was undoubtedly the leader, instituted first at Paris, then at Marseille, and then afterwards at Brussels, a new rite which they called the Rite of Memphis, and which consisted of 91, and of course we know that they eventually added it all the way up to 97 degrees. Subsequently, another degree was added to this already too long list. The right, however, has repeatedly undergone modifications. The Rite of Memphis was undoubtedly founded on the extinct Rite of Mizraim. For, as Ragon says, and he's a French Masonic authority, the Egyptian Rite seems to have inspired Marconis and Moulay in their organization of their new Rite. It is said by Ragon, that, who has written copiously on the Rite, that the first series of degrees extending to the 35th degree is an assumption of the 33 degrees of the ancient and accepted Rite, that's Scottish Rite, with scarcely a change of name. The remaining degrees of the Rite are borrowed, according to the same authority, from other well-known systems, and some perhaps the invention of their founders. The Rite of Memphis was not at first recognized by the Grand Orient of France, and consequently formed no part of legal French Freemasonry. So, about 1852, its lodges were closed by the civil authority, and the Rite, to use a French Masonic phrase, they went to sleep. In other words, the lodges went dark. A lodge was operating in 1859 as the Reformed Masonic Order of Memphis, or Rite of the Grand Lodge of Philadelphia in England, and issuing certificates of membership. The Grand Secretary of the Grand Lodge of England therefore sent out a circular warning members of the English lodges against spurious lodges claiming to be Masonic. At this point, I'm going to discuss this whole business of clandestine lodges. A clandestine lodge is defined as belonging to an organization that claims to make Masons, and they claim to make Masons, and they can have some kind of a ritual. But if the way it works is if you have to be a Mason to get into them, then they are that's also considered being clandestine if they insist that you be a Mason from a regular jurisdiction. And this is where people get in trouble. Regular Masons get in trouble in joining something like M&M. You really get in trouble, because if you show your dues card to get into one of their rituals, you and your Grand Lodge finds out about it, you're going to be wishing you hadn't. Now, to continue, though. In the year 1862, Marconis, still faithful to the system which he had invented, applied to the Grand Master of France to give it a new life. The Grand College of Rites was consulted on the subject, and the Council of the Order, having made a favorable decree, the Rite of Memphis was admitted in November 1862, among those Masonic systems which acknowledge obedience to the Grand Orient of France and perform their functions within its bosom. To obtain this position, however, the only one which in France preserves a Masonic system from the reputation of being clandestine, it was necessary that Marconis, who was then the Grand Hierophant, should, as a step preliminary to any favorable action on the part of the Grand Orient, take an obligation by which he forever after divested himself of all authority of any kind whatsoever over the Rite. It passed entirely out of his hands. And going into the obedience of the Grand Orient, that body has taken complete and undivided possession of it, and laid it, its advanced degrees, upon the shelf as Masonic curiosities, since the Grand Orient only recognizes in practice the 33 degrees of the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite. Now that That is the key to all this business. And this didn't happen just once. It's happened several times. In fact, I think it's happened in this country. This then became the position of the Rite of Memphis in France. Its original possessors have disclaimed all further control or direction of it. It has been admitted by the Grand Orient among the 8 systems of rites which are placed under its obedience. That is to say, it admits its existence, but it does not suffer it to be worked. Like all Masonic rites that have ever been invented, the organization of the Rite of Memphis is founded on the first 3 degrees of ancient craft masonry. And these 3 degrees, of course, are given in symbolic lodges. That's what we call blue lodges. In 1862, when Marconis surrendered the rite into the hands of the ruling powers of the French Freemasonry, many of these lodges existed in various parts of France, and although in a dormant condition, because as we have already seen, 10 years before, they had been closed by the civil authority. Had they been in active operation, they would not have been recognized by the French Freemasons. They would have been looked upon as clandestine, and there would have been no affiliation with them. Because the Grand Orient recognizes no Masonic body as legal, which do not, in return, recognize it as the head of French Freemasonry. But when Marconis surrendered his powers as Grand Hierophant to the Rite of Memphis and to the Grand Orient, that body permitted these lodges to be resuscitated and reopened only on the condition that they would acknowledge their submission to the Grand Orient and that they would work only its first 3 degrees and never confer any degree higher than that of Master Mason. The members of these lodges, however high, might be their dignities in the rites of Memphis, and were to be recognized only as Master Masons. In other words, the Rite of Memphis could give them all kinds of fancy degrees with impressive titles, but that didn't mean anything to the Grand Orient. These people were no higher than Master Masons as far as they were concerned. And that's kind of almost a general rule. That red lodges, and that's advanced higher lodges, you really, all of their members, no matter, you might be the prince of the royal secret and all the rest of this, but you're still, when it comes right down to it, you're a Master Mason. These titles, a lot of them are, almost supercilious, and you can satire them endlessly, like, he's the keeper of the royal chamber pot, or something like that. They're really just honorary, and that same thing applies, by the way, in as far as we're concerned in our organization. We give a person a fancy title, give them a fancy degree, but that doesn't give them any particular power. They think it does sometimes, but it doesn't. Now, such became the condition of the Rite of Memphis in France that it was absorbed into the Grand Orient. Marconis, its founder and head, surrendered all claim to any jurisdiction over it. And there are lodges under the jurisdiction of the Grand Orient which originally belonged to the Rite of Memphis, and they practice its ritual, but only so far as to give degrees of apprentice, fellow craft, and master mason. Let's digress a little bit here and explain something about this. Because Grand Orient did take both Mizraim and Memphis and literally put them on the shelf, or as Waite put it, put them in one of their pigeonholes. And because of that, they had it. In other words, they had the right, as it says here. They possessed it. But when a fellow by the name of Seymour over in the United States, he decided to get it going back in Pike's time. when they had the little turf war between Rite of Memphis and regular Scottish Rite. And this I found out from Calvin Brutt's documentation on this, he got the Grand Orient of France to agree to have reciprocity with the northern jurisdiction of Scottish Rite. But what he didn't do, so he got them to do that, but what he didn't do was actually get their permission to use Memphis and Mizraim, but he just made that assumption, and he just proceeded to try to get it going here in this country. And for a while, he was initiating his brothers in Scottish Rite. And when Scottish Rite finally, when they realized that, my gosh, these people are getting very powerful and really, and so Scottish Rite had to prevailed upon the various Grand Lodges, and they had themselves a bit of a, and they had some legal hassles and one thing or other, but finally Scottish Rite, the various Grand Lodges. Now in the United States we don't have like the Grand Orient or the Grand Lodge of France or the United Grand Lodge of England. We don't have that. We don't have an American United Grand Lodge. There's a phony one on the internet. You can find the United Grand Lodge of the United States, but it's completely phony. And so each state has its own Grand Lodge. But they do have a certain this kind of commonality that they follow. These advanced lodges, like the Arkwright, which has the Knights Templar section, that's the more Christian-oriented higher degrees of masonry, Royal Arch and Cryptic Precincts and those. And by the way, all of their rituals were copied and stuck into Memphis and Mizraim too. Memphis and Mizraim ended up to be literally a grab bag of every Masonic ritual that these people could manage to get a copy of. And of course, obviously, if you're going to stage rituals, there are scripts floating around. it does happen. So York Rite and Scottish Rite were the leading Red Lodges, the ones that after you became Master Mason, then you could go ahead and you could get into either York Rite or Scottish Rite, or do both of them. I did both of them, but you can work your way up through and through those degrees and personally, I think Scottish Rite is really, 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 really a significant experience. I very much recommend it. As I said, Memphis, the Rite of Memphis was appealing to people with this idea. See, they had a charter myth that I think we ought to discuss. You know, the charter myth on Masonry is the Hiram Abiff story, and we're all familiar with that. You know, the architect of the temple and King Solomon and King Hiram of Tyre, the Phoenician, and Hiram Abiff, the architect of the three grand masters building the temple. And then, of course, Hiram gets murdered by three disgruntled workmen because he won't give them the secret. And that's the charter myth basically of Freemasonry. In Memphis and Mizraim, they had to have one too, you know. So they came up with this thing about this Coptic priest or bishop or something in Cairo, who back in hundreds of years ago came out with all these degrees and that became supposedly the basis for the foundation of all the Scottish Rite and some of the York Rite degrees and whatever. And 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 uh, this was there. Then he, in turn, communicated this to some other people, and finally this thing supposedly got established. Well, this is a myth. This is a charter myth, and it's sort of like Fräulein Sprengel and the Golden Dawn. It's a good story, but you know, there's no foundation in fact on it at all. And actually, Marcotis and Moulet and the other Frenchman who started the earlier rite of Mizraim, they did this themselves, and they invented their own charter myth. Now, I don't want to give the impression that there isn't some valuable material in M&M. There is. And for one thing, when it got over to England, it came under the wing of a man who just was a prodigious kind of a autodidacte type scholar, sort of a self-educated scholar who collected Masonic rites, and even more so than Memphis and Mizraim, he collected a lot of them. And this guy's name was John Yarker, and he just was fascinated with the Memphis and Mizraim. So he started it in England, and briefly, as we said, he got some permission to get it going. But eventually, the same thing happened. Of course, you know, they realized that it was that so many of the degrees were just lifted from Scottish Rite that Grand Lodge of England, I don't believe, recognizes it, you know, at this point either. But John Yarker, he, as we had already said, John Yarker edited and the English translation of these rites. And he did a lot of editing and improving, because he was quite a good Masonic scholar. And he also added von Hund's Crater Ripoa, which is, of course, very, very important to us. And so he added the Crater Ripoa. But what Yarker did when he added the Crater Ripoa is he squeezed all 7 degrees of Crater Ripoa down into 1 degree that he put into in his version of the Rite of Memphis, and he called it the Sage of Mithras. It's the 64th degree. Now, he did a nice job of condensing. Of course, Paul Christian in History and Practice of Magic, Paul Christian condensed the two and the initiation into the pyramids, but which is the one that we started off with. But Yarker had his translation of Crater Ripoa was from one of the German versions, which got translated into French, and so Yarker got it from the French along with the rest of the Rite of Memphis, I guess, and then he translated it into English. And as most of you know, Manly Hall published it as Freemasonry of the Ancient Egyptians. Now, Yarker called it the 64th degree of Memphis and Mizraim, the Sage of Mithras. Now, this is a valid analogy, because there is a lot of Mithriatic symbolism in Hermetic philosophy and in Hermetic, if you want to call it theology, and also vice versa. The Hermetic tradition influenced the Mithra, the Western version of Mithraism, and the Western version of Mithraism in turn and influenced Hermetic magic, and so there's an interchange here. There's a lot of similarities. But what Yarker did that is important, the original German version of Crater Ripoa by von Hund, there is a cipher, a magical cipher called the Royal Beam Cipher. Now, this is This is a 24-letter version of Pigpen. And for those of you who don't know what Pigpen is, well, you should. Pigpen is a cipher. It's a cipher grid, and it's very clever, and it's been used. It's been used in masonry and in magic, and it was even used as a military cipher all the way up to the war between the states. And what it is you take two grids, two tic-tac-toe grids, and in other words, you draw a couple of a pair of lines parallel to each other, and then you draw two more lines parallel to each other coming down and bisecting them, which gives you a square in the middle. Now, if you do this twice, and then you end up with 22 angles. Well, that's fine for the Hebrew alphabet, and that's Masonically for quite a while that's what they used, and York Rite does and whatever, in the Hermetic era in old Alexandria, where this whole thing got started, including the Kabbalah, they used the 24-letter Greek alphabet. And frankly, the Kabbalah was created originally on the 24-letter Greek alphabet. And why 24 letters rather than 22? Well, they wanted to have a letter, 12 letters across the zodiac, one letter for each decan of the zodiac, for each, you know, not one each decan, one letter for each sign going across, and then that goes all the way up to the North Pole. And then you whip this thing around, what we call Mustafa, and you go the other way, and then you get another 12 letters, and that goes all the way down to the South Pole, and this way you have entablated the entire universe. Has a series, a grid of Greek letters applied to it, and we have an article on this in the Seventh Ray, the third issue, the Seventh Ray. That's what we call the Green Ray. And those of you who haven't gotten that, it's available on Amazon, and they have them in stock right now. So you go ahead and you can one click the Green Ray. That's the Seventh Ray, Volume 3. And it has the key to this, by the way, was developed by the Valentinian Christian Gnostic Marcus. He's the one who, in fact, Marcus's system is the source of Kieran Berry's The Greek Kabbalah, which is another book you ought to have if you want to get into this. So here this Royal Beam cipher, the way they did it, here they have this 22-letter, two grids, which give you 22 separate angles, or squares, or whatever. And in order to make it into 24, they just did an X in the center of the middle chamber. They just bisected it, put an X in there, and then that gave them 24 angles. And so they could fill out the whole alphabet. What you do, by the way, is you take one set of letters, the first 12, they just go on the angles with nothing in them. And then the second set of 12, you put a dot in each one of the angles, and that indicates the second set of 12. And that's the key to the cipher. Now, Yarker, when he published a translation from French into English of the Kreiteropoulos, the one that Manly Hall eventually published, and he left out the Royal Beam cipher. He referred to it, but he didn't explain it. He didn't show it. Why? Because he wanted to save it for his Sage of Mithras, which he inserted into Eminem. Okay, so So you have to, in order to really find out about the Royal Meme cipher of Credor and Poa, you got to go to Yarker's version of M&M, which of course we do, and that part of it is significant. There's other things, by the way. There are other things in M&M that are valuable because it became, you know, it became a sort of a grab bag for everything that people wanted to, you know, that people like Yarker wanted to preserve. So there are significant things in M&M, and I'm not saying there aren't, even though Pike and all the rest of them didn't think there were, but there are. Let's skip to Kenneth McKenzie, who, as you may remember, was the author of the Golden Dawn Cipher Manuscript. He did the Masonic Cyclopedia, and he says about this, "Mizraim, right of, with which we shall discuss the Rite of Memphis. Leshanguer," that's that Frenchman that did Mizraim, "is said to have founded this rite, but there is evidence to prove that this is an error and that he only used previous material." Yeah, that's right. That's the mind Scottish rite. "In point of fact, the Rite of Mizraim rose out of Egyptian masonry, which Cagliostro derived from an older source. The ancient and accepted rite claims priority, but it is difficult to decide the historical merits of the question. It has been stated that 66 degrees of the Rite of Mizraim were taken from the ancient and accepted rite, but as the latter had at first from the emperors of the East and West only 25 and 8 degrees added, so it is affirmed by Frederick II, surnamed the Great. It is difficult to understand how 66 can have been got out of 33. Well, it's not difficult to understand because they took them from both. They took the 33 that Mizraim took, and then they took the 33 that Memphis took, and they combined them, so they had 66, and then they had to invent a bunch more because they had to change them. 66 could have gotten out of 33. Leshanguer, Jolie, and the Vedarides soon spread the rite all over Italy. And in 1814, it reached France, an absolute sovereign grand master with irresponsible authority governs the rite. But this system of government did not agree with the fraternity, and 11 brethren, among whom were Ragone and Gaboria, Nicolet, and me, and Millet and others, united under the presidency of Jolet to create and establish the Rite of Mizraim in its four series of and 90 degrees in virtues of the powers obtained from Naples. Now, I'm going to backtrack a little bit here because this is important. Kenneth McKenzie here is referring to Cagliostro. And Cagliostro is Egyptian rite. And I don't think we've ever done a show on Cagliostro's Egyptian rite. I think we've mentioned it a few times. It has some influence. But it certainly influenced the Rite of Memphis as far as their theology is concerned. In this respect, they claim Rite of Mizraim claims to be Egyptian. Mizraim, by the way, is the name applied to ancient Egypt in the chapter 10 of the Book of Genesis, when they're naming all the nations of the world at that time. Mizraim was what they called Egypt. So, what Cagliostro did, because he was Masonry was so biblical, And Cagliostro was a very conscientious Mason, in spite of some of the things that they said about him. Yeah, Orson Welles doing that movie on him, whatever. But Cagliostro was a dedicated Mason and very, very bright. He wanted to keep his Egyptian rite in keeping with the Bible. So as far as Cagliostro was concerned, Enoch and Seth were older than Isis and Osiris. Yeah, because the Bible said that these are antediluvian. Now, this, by the way, is where our whole antediluvian Masonic tradition comes from. I think it starts with Cagliostro. Now, I think Fred Herbert should probably disagree with me on this, but I think Cagliostro really set the tone for this. And so you go into Genesis and Mizraim, and of course Memphis, it was one of the main holy centers in Egypt, where they had the temple. I forget which big temple was there, but there was certainly Memphis is a sacred city. Now, as I said, Cagliostro believed that the prophets, the antediluvian prophets, and that's primarily Enoch and Seth, were more significant and earlier than Isis and Osiris, the rest of them, and this is where we get the legends of the pillars, of Hermes and Seth. And especially if you've been through an OTA second degree, you're very familiar with that. But the pillars in the temple, these were supposedly created before the flood, and covered with significant hieroglyphics. Even though this is supposed to be, and some of this crept into the Credit Report, even though this is supposed to be ancient Egyptian, it is more Genesis pre-flood biblical than it really is ancient Egyptian. I mean, we're not talking about Ptah and Amun-Ra and Isis and Osiris and Horus. We're not talking about that at all. That's all came later as far as these guys were concerned. And so the underpinning of all of this is antediluvian. What I mean by that is before the flood. And some people, get into this and they run with it, and they think that the book of Enoch, Ethiopian Enoch, comes from that era. Well, it claims that it does, but it really doesn't. Ethiopian Enoch is not that old, this is where this antediluvian tradition, even all the way into Masonry, and we find it in York Rite, and we find it, and we even find echoes of it in Scottish Rite, but especially in the Rite of Memphis, this underlies the Rite of Memphis, and. That's one thing that I wanted to point out, because Masonry is going to be biblical, because we're working our way up to Solomon's Temple, and so they're certainly going to have as much biblical symbolism and biblical mythology as they can work in. Let's get into Yarker's version here. Yarker's version. I'll read you a little bit of the Sage of Mithras here that he. Okay. Let's see. A Julian symbol, a delta, in the middle of which is a parallelogram with 7 points. That should be familiar to some of you. Okay. Conduct the aspirant to the, at this point, conduct the aspirant to the Hieros Talista, that he may be instructed in our secret cipher, after which let him be seated. And the Hydranos takes him over to the Hieros Talista. And the Hieros Talista says, Aramanian alphabet is that of the ancient Egyptian priests and formed of, out of three diagrams. First is the triangle, the origin of all things. Second is the square, the sign of truth. Third is the X, like the cross of St. Andrew, which was the nth degree of perfection. And if you run the triangle around about its center, you obtain this figure, and they show a Maltese cross here. With these ciphers, you obtain our alphabet. It was called the Amenian, and the royal building beam. And consult, and then they had to consult Plutarch's De Mori Fratermo and Diodorus Siculus and Brocard and whatever. So they're giving, like in the Crater of Poa. Now the Crater of Poa, as those of you who are familiar with it, is actually a very scholarly piece of work, because Von Hund, when they put it together, he consulted every classical source to try to reconstruct an Alexandrian hermetic initiation, and he did a great job. And yet he did a great job, except when he got to the astronomical degree, and then he must have decided that somehow or other that he didn't like astrology, and that of course was very sad, because that's the bedrock of hermetic magic, and we pointed that out in our version of the Crater of Poa, which I thought that he was influenced, that Von Hund was influenced by the Illuminati, because the Illuminati, well, they had their own particular astrological calendar, but otherwise they did not like any of the contemporary astrology. So I thought it was an influence of the Illuminati in the astronomer's degree. Actually, it wasn't, because the Crater of Poa came before the Illuminati, and we found out just recently that the Illuminati took the fourth degree of Crater of Poa, Chiesa Forest, they took it, and they lifted it out, and they put it into their Minerval, one of their Minerval degrees, and they communicated it. When I say, now this is another point, a good point to understand. There are two ways to give someone a degree. If you confer the degree, this means that you are, you have him in the lodge room, and you have the officers, they're in regalia, and you walk him around the lodge room to the stations, and you actually put him through his initiation. That's conferring a degree. If you communicate a degree, you can do that by reading it to him, or you can put a copy of it in an envelope and mail it to him, with a letter saying, congratulations, you're now a prince of the royal chamber pot, or something like that. You can do that. And so what the Illuminati did was they took the fourth degree of Crater Poet, and they communicated it, they read it, to their Minervals. And then, after they read it, they gave them their owl medallion, and the little owl medallion of the Illuminati. And when we found that out, we decided, okay, well, now we can hide now. If they did that, they did that to Crater of Poa, well, Crater of Poa can now have their owl. So you guys who want to get up to your fourth degree, those of you who have fourth degree, you're entitled to an owl. But don't expect us to give you one at this point. we're going to have to charge you for the owl when we get them. However, if you want your Illuminati owl, we're going to have them. And basically, we have them because our fourth degree got communicated to them. That's the difference. But now, let me point something else out here. This is another way that a lodge can become clandestine. You can become clandestine if you start communicating, either conferring or communicating genuine Masonic degrees. Now, M&M did this. They had all these Masonic degrees that they collected, and they were communicating a lot of them there because they didn't have it. You know, there was a lot of them that all they had was a paragraph. And if you read Greenfield's book, so-called Complete Rite of Memphis, most of them are just paragraphs. And you know these things were communicated. And if they were conferred, somebody just read you the paragraph, and maybe he put his hand on your shoulder and said, "Now you're a knight of the royal broom closet," or something like that. But what the Illuminati did, and they shouldn't have done it. They said, well, at this particular point, we have all these Scottish Rite degrees. We have all these degrees, and for a fee, in a fairly large fee, they said, we will put them all in an envelope for you, and we'll give them to you. But you probably won't like them. You probably won't learn anything from them. But if you want them, you can have them. We'll communicate, but you have to make a large donation for that. And in a sense, M&M was kind of doing the same thing. This is one of the objections that Pike and others had to them, that M&M was a kind of a degree mill, and they were getting money for their degrees. Well, in fact, Crowley, when he did his OTO rituals, he presumed to absorb M&M into the OTO. Oh, yeah, I used to have a copy of Crowley's original OTO rituals in his own handwriting. I eventually, when it started to fade on me, I turned it over to Juan Duquette. But you can see in there where he's talking about we have all the rites of Memphis and Mizraim, and uses their but then where he made a bad mistake was at a certain point in the OTO rituals I don't think it's Saladin at that point. I think it's some other officer. Tells the candidate, you are now entitled to all of the degrees of Scottish Rite or a certain section of the degrees of Scottish Rite, and we'll bestow them upon you. And that right there, unless they change that, the OTO, that would have meant, if they didn't change it, then they did. There wouldn't be an OTO member in California that could sit in a California lodge until they changed that, and they were smart enough to take it out. But let me say this, before we get to the end of this, a few weeks ago I was discussing this and that little incident, and then another incident that about this clandestine thing that. And I said that my friend and brother, Worshipful Michael Downs, had sicked Jeff Peace on me, and that then Jeff Peace tried to get me and other California Masons here in this area involved in one of their M&M extravaganzas, and I had to go ahead and get in touch with the legal officer at Grand Lodge and find out just what we could do and what we couldn't do. And I want to make it clear that I did not mean to imply that Worshipful Michael Downs was connected with M&M. He did refer Jeff Peace, who was the promoter of M&M. He did refer Jeff to, he told Jeff Peace, well, if you want to get in touch with with Esoteric Masons in California, you should get in touch with Pope Runyon, and you ought to get in touch with Lon Duquette. Well, I don't, you know, I don't know whether Jeff ever got in touch with Lon Duquette, but he sure got in touch with me, and naturally, because Crowder Apollo was part of Yarker's M&M, I was interested, you know, sure, you know, that's, and you can, you know, you can be interested in M&M, and if you belong to the College of Rites, where it resides, you can go study it. And any Mason can belong to the College of Rites if he wants to, but what Jeff Peace, first Alan Greenfield published this short version, which was not complete, and then Jeff Peace decided that he would promote, get this thing launched, but what he wanted to do, and where Jeff Peace made his big mistake, was that he wanted to get Memphis Mizraim and to get regular Masons into it, because regular Masons had been, he wanted to start the turf war between Memphis and Mizraim back in the 1800s. He wanted to start it all over again, and this was a mistake, because they came out here and they rented the Glendale Masonic Center, and then they got in touch with all of the esoteric Masons that they knew in Southern California, and they said, well, we're going to put on we're going to have a meet and greet downstairs in the dining room, and we're going to have graphics, and we'll have a dog and pony show, and then we're going to have a ritual upstairs in the lodge room, and you be sure and bring your dues card, and show us that you're a regular Mason, and you can come to the ritual. Well, I saw this, and I thought, well, gee, that'd be interesting. But I wondered, what about this showing your dues card? So I called up the Grand Lodge legal officer, who I happen to know, and I ran this by him, and he said, whoa. He said, you guys could go to the dog and pony show. Go to the dog and pony show and eat all their crackers and cheese and drink their wine, do whatever you want, but don't go up into that ritual to show. If you show your dues card, you go in, you're in trouble, because you're participating in a clandestine Masonic activity, because M&M is definitely considered by Grand Lodge California to be clandestine, and so I put the word out to all of my Masonic friends. I said, well, we gotta be careful here, and. Yeah, as a result of that, I didn't even go to the dog and pony show. I suppose I should have because I am, I am interested in the material. Like I said, Crowder Apollo got scarfed up into M&M, and they saved our Royal Beam cipher for us, which was good. The Order of Memphis and Mizraim, by the way, I think I was looking up on the internet, cruising around on it, looking for it, and I got right across its page, and you can find it, I think now hopefully they've gotten over this business of trying to get regular Masons into it, so non-Masons can get into it. Well, I'm not saying you shouldn't. But for heaven's sake, if you do, don't do what some OTO Masons did, and that is go into a lodge room and do an M&M rite by exemplification. And you can find this on YouTube, by the way. It's a bunch of young OTO guys in an OTO temple. And they're exemplifying what I mean by exemplifying is they're staging it. That means if you exemplify a rite, you're staging it, but you're not you're staging it, but you're not bestowing it, you're not conferring it, and that's how we stage a rite. You know, if we just want to stage it without actually initiating somebody, and these kids are in there giving Masonic raid signs, like they were, and I looked at this and I thought, oh gosh, you know, why endanger? This endangers, doing this endangers all of the OTO members and the entire state that they did this in are put in jeopardy by them doing something like this. So I want to caution you, those of you who are Masons, I want to caution you. I don't know about co-Masons. I don't know what the co-Masonic jurisdiction's attitude toward this is. But if you're not a Mason, or if your particular jurisdiction is sympathetic to these people, some of them may be, then go ahead. There is interesting material in here, and the M&M people have they're trying to get this thing going. So I'm not. I don't want to give the impression that I don't like it or anything like that. I'm just a little bit afraid of it. that's about the reason for caution. But it's interesting. It's very interesting, and it does have some very interesting material in it. So that just about wraps us up. And next week, we've got some really interesting material that just came in. I'm trying to work up another show that will be hopefully just as exciting and informative as this one. And so until then, good magic.